know that there's more than one place that they're hauling out. And if they do anything like they did back in 2007, there'll probably be several locations along the coast that they haul out on.
The Chukchi Sea Ice Retreat forces thousands of walruses to land. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 8th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a crowded field for the Democratic nomination for governor.
Leadership is a big part of it, and just getting the state back on track would be wonderful.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
For only the second time in human memory, a large number of walruses are coming to shore on Alaska's northern coast. The Chukchi Sea ice has retreated far north beyond the productive waters of the continental shelf where the animals prefer to forage. Also, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service today formally accepted a petition to consider listing Pacific walrus under the Endangered Species Act. APRN's Annie Fite reports.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration has been doing aerial surveys of the coast all summer, looking for walruses. Chad Jay is a researcher with the United States Geological Survey. He says NOAA is now reporting over 3,500 walruses hauled out at Icy Cape between Wainwright and Point Lay.
We suspect there's some other areas that walruses are hauled out on as well. We have two walruses that still have radio tags on the air. That were tagged back in July off of Barrow, and those animals are down around the Cape Lisburn area. So we know that there's more than one place that they're hauling out, and if they do anything like they did back in 2007, there'll probably be several locations along the coast that they haul out on.
2007 was the first year walruses hauled out on Alaska's coast because of sea ice retreat in the Chukchi Sea. About 6,000 animals came to shore that year. When the sea ice drifts near the continental shelf, it carries walruses over shallow ocean waters that hold a rich buffet of their favorite food. Clams. Jay says because this is such a new phenomenon, there isn't any data on how the walruses respond to having to make long foraging trips from land instead. But his sense is that the animals have to spend a lot more energy to find food.
These are adult females, females with young, and when the females leave the coast to go out and forage, the young go with them. So that it's at a greater expense probably to them, too, because they have to travel further.
Jay and two colleagues are heading up to Point Lay and Wainwright next week to deploy radio tags on walruses hauled out in the area. The biologists want to figure out how far offshore the animals are traveling to find food and how much effort it takes. They'll compare that data to walruses who use the sea ice to forage earlier in the summer. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is also working with coastal communities to get the word out that the animals on land should be disturbed as little as possible.
The animals are there to rest, and they need to rest, and sometimes they can be quite exhausted. And so that's something that the Fish and Wildlife Service Marine Mammals Management Office is working on in mitigating the disturbances to walruses.
Sea ice loss is at the heart of the Fish and Wildlife Service's decision to consider whether to list walruses under the Endangered Species Act. The agency released a preliminary finding that an endangered or threatened listing may be necessary for the species. Joel Garlick Miller is a walrus biologist with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service in Anchorage. He says the importance of sea ice for walrus feeding and raising their young is well established.
We have certainly seen significant changes in sea ice habitat over the past decade, and what that means in terms of the sustainability of the population is what we're going to try to figure out in the next little while.
The agency wants to gather as much public input on the potential listing as possible. That process is open for the next 60 days. The agency has a year to make a final decision. The Center for Biological Diversity petitioned the Fish and Wildlife Service to list the walrus last year and then sued to force this decision. Rebecca Noblin is a staff attorney with the organization. She calls the finding great news and says the science is pretty clear that the walrus is in big trouble.
They're working on population abundance studies right now. We expect the findings of those studies to come in and show that walrus are already in decline and will continue to decline. So we hope it's likely that Fish and Wildlife will we'll go ahead and list Pacific walrus.
Pacific walruses live in the Bering and Chukchi Seas. In 2007, tens of thousands of walruses hauled out on the Russian coast as well. Biologists there reported trampling deaths that killed many of the youngest and smaller animals. Chad Jay says he hasn't heard reports of large numbers of animals hauling out in Russia yet this year, but he suspects walruses are starting to arrive at that coast as well. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
The state is reporting another death from H1N1 flu. The person is a middle-aged woman from Seward who had a combination of respiratory and other underlying medical conditions. She is the third confirmed death in Alaska from H1N1. Over the weekend, a child from Fairbanks who was previously healthy died of the illness. In the midst of all this, the state's new chief medical officer and director for the Division of Public Health had his first day on the job today. Dr. Ward Hurlburt says the state is doing more testing now to figure out whether the Fairbanks child had a secondary infection.
The CDC will be working with us on that. The reason why that's important is that the whole world, and in the sense of what we're talking, meaning CDC and WHO, have been concerned about any potential genetic mutation of the virus, as apparently happened in the 1918 flu epidemic. There does not seem to be reason to have alarm or concern about that based on the tragic situation with this young boy.
Is it known, do you have an idea of when the test results may be back so that there will be a better understanding of what happened?
The viral genetic typing takes a long time. The samples have gone to Atlanta, to CDC, but that could be weeks or even months before you get the final result on that. Before that, the medical examiner's office was going to perform the autopsy because this was an unexpected death, and that's the kind of situation that falls in their bailiwick. And they will be working with CDC, looking at what they find on some of the various tissues and organs on the autopsy with CDC. So that may give strong evidence earlier than waiting for the viral genetic typing. But the viral genetic typing is just it's a process that takes considerable time and that really can't go faster.
The fact that this child was apparently healthy before he got sick may certainly worry some parents. What are you hearing, and how concerned would you be sending a child to school?
There have been 36 deaths up until this time in the United States for children who had the H1N1 flu. About three-quarters of that number had underlying significant chronic illnesses. So about a quarter, about nine of them did not have that. Children can have, in uncommon situations, they can just have a devastating situation like this little boy had where they become ill. So it happens. It's not common, but it does happen.
You have a lot of experience working in public health in Alaska. What do you think the biggest health challenges facing the state are?
The biggest health challenges that we have would be issues that as Americans and as Alaskans, so often our deaths now and our premature deaths are from what I would call diseases of choice. And that needs to be something we continue to focus on. The use of tobacco products is still the leading cause of unavoidable and premature death. Obesity is creeping up on it, but tobacco is still the leading cause. We have a good sense of success in that we've dropped from about 27 or 28% of smokers among adults in Alaska to around the 20% range. However, there was a report about a week ago out of Puget Sound where they're down to about the 10.8% range. So in the long run, probably the most critical thing that the Division of Public Health gets engaged in.
And Dr. Hurlburt, how do you think Alaska fits into the broader debate on healthcare reform that's going on in the country right now?
We have some unique challenges here. Probably one of the foremost being just the logistics of healthcare. With the distances that we have, the 85% of our communities not being on a linked road system, and that's kind of a challenge that other states don't have. So there are certainly very some very unique things, and I believe there is opportunity in making the decisions for care to strengthen the consistency of those decisions with strong scientific evidence, and we, along with the rest of the country, hopefully will be a part of that.
Dr. Ward Hurlburt is Alaska's new chief medical officer. An Alaskan-based soldier from Texas has died in Afghanistan. The Department of Defense today identified the soldier as 25-year-old Staff Sergeant Michael Murfree. He died Sunday in Paktika Province, Afghanistan, from wounds suffered when his unit was attacked with an improvised explosive device. Murfree was assigned to Fort Richardson in Anchorage. At least five Fort Richardson paratroopers have died in Afghanistan in the last 3 weeks. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a golfing adventure in Southeast.
I did purchase more golf balls on the second time around. A total of 10 golf balls, finished with two.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30th, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus Oregon Province.
Add another name to your choices for governor in the 2010 election.
Filed my letter of intent with AIPAC, and I am running for governor.
That's Ethan Berkowitz, the former leader of the Democrats in the State House of Representatives and last year's party nominee for Congress. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Ethan Berkowitz joins four other candidates on the Democratic Party ballot next August. And party chair Patty Higgins says she's happy to have what she calls a deep bench. She says the past 6.5 years of Republicans in the governor's office brought out qualified people who can accomplish a lot of good for Alaska.
They see a need, and they think that they can fill it, and leadership is a big part of it. And just getting the state back on track would be wonderful.
Higgins says the one to continue to the general election against the Republican nominee will be well-liked, trusted, and most importantly, will be able to communicate with the people. Berkowitz says Alaska needs leaders who can make changes in the state.
Voters are now in a time of uncertainty, and we have the resources to solve the problems, to bring certainty. And they're going to make decisions based on someone they can identify with and someone who they think shares their values.
He says his campaign will show that he has the ability to bring Alaskans together in a nonpartisan way to develop solutions to the state's problems.
This is part of what hasn't happened is the state hasn't been part of people's solutions. It's gotten in the way. And the state hasn't solved problems like the high cost of energy. It hasn't solved problems like deteriorating infrastructure. And the state has a role to play in making sure that those problems get solved. And there's been a leadership vacuum for too long.
The other three contenders are former Commissioner of Administration Bob Poe, State Senator Hollis French, and Homer's Rob Rosenfeld, a director of the Yukon River Intertribal Watershed Council. The election is August 24th. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
A University of Alaska Fairbanks student group is trying to raise awareness of fetal alcohol syndrome disorder, or FASD. The UAF Pre-Med Society is hosting events tomorrow, which is FASD Awareness Day. Fetal alcohol syndrome can result when a woman drinks alcohol during pregnancy. It causes growth, mental, and physical problems in children exposed to alcohol while in the womb. Head of the Pre-Med Society's Community and Environmental Health Committee, Carla Cartagena, says the idea of the event is to raise FAS awareness on campus.
We're trying to reach the students mostly. It hasn't been done, but we decided, the students are here. Some of them are sexually active. Some of them are drinking. So just a precaution.
Cartagena says most students don't know much about the risk of FAS.
Every time I bring up the subject, you know, that we're going to have this activity, most of the kids are like, so how much alcohol is allowed that women can drink? And a lot of doctors are like, you shouldn't be drinking at all while pregnant. And I find it surprising that students would even ask that. I think it's second nature to me just to think you shouldn't be drinking at all while you're pregnant. There's students out there thinking, no, there might be some levels that are okay. So it's pretty shocking that they don't know it's a big problem in Alaska either.
The Pre-Med Society is hosting speakers, including Diane Casto, who manages state prevention and early intervention services for the Department of Behavioral Health. Casto says Alaska has a major problem with alcohol, and FAS is one of the results. She says there's no hard science on how much alcohol it takes to damage a developing fetus.
It depends upon how you metabolize alcohol, and everyone metabolizes it differently. Your weight, the timing of when you drink alcohol, the type of alcohol you drink, and the percentage of alcohol in that drink. So there are so many variables that has been one of the problems of having hard science about how much alcohol does it take to damage a fetus.
Casto says even though it's hard to gauge the effect of even small amounts of alcohol, it's clear drinking during pregnancy does impact the developing fetus, particularly the brain. She says because of that, the FASD prevention message is very straightforward.
We say do not drink any alcohol during pregnancy. It's the only way you can be 100% sure and be 100% safe that your growing baby is not being damaged by alcohol.
Casto says her message will be tailored to college students when she speaks at UAF tomorrow. She says most students who drink aren't alcoholics, but that even social drinking represents risk. She says alcohol impairs judgment, and that can result in unprotected sex and unplanned pregnancy.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at pennair.com. And by the Alaska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline.
Federal officials say plans for a new nationwide aquaculture policy will not immediately affect Alaska. Acting Administrator Jim Balsiger announced last week that NOAA Fisheries will reassess existing policies on fish farming in federal waters. He says the goal is to establish a comprehensive national policy framework to govern fin and shellfish aquaculture management. But he says development of plans for specific areas will be up to regional management councils. That means Alaska could continue to keep salmon farms out.
If we have a national framework, but with the plans coming through the council systems, not the Fisher Management Council, of course, would be in a position to not take up an aquaculture plan, in which case there may not be a permitting authority or a regulation that could be developed.
Alaska prohibits salmon and other fin fish farms in state waters, although shellfish farms are allowed. Commercial fisheries groups oppose aquaculture in federal waters, which are further offshore. Last week, the Anchorage School District opened a new facility downtown on 4th Avenue. It's called Step Up and represents a unique approach to the district's proclaimed goal, educating all students for success in life. KSK's Len Anderson reports.
According to Dean Williams from the state's Division of Juvenile Justice, the Step Up program arose from the anti-youth and gang violence effort that began about 4 years ago. One of the recommendations arising from a citizens and agency representative group was directed toward expelled or suspended youth who did not qualify for existing alternative education programs.
Nationwide research, of course, confirms what we all already know anecdotally, that these youth represent a high risk to become criminally or gang involved. At the very least, they're less likely to earn a living wage.
Williams explained that prospective step-up students are those who did not commit minor infractions like excessive tardiness or alcohol possession that leads to in-school suspension, especially now with the newly expanded in-school suspension program started this year by the Anchorage School District. But neither was their behavior so bad that it led to incarceration. Williams says their rule breaking is more likely to involve shoving another student or fighting in school.
The irony, of course, is that if a youth was heading down the long stint at a juvenile facility such as McLaughlin, their educational opportunities would greatly increase. The problem was they had to commit more crimes in order to be eligible for a second chance at getting their education back. So the Step Up program was developed to give a second chance to kids who don't qualify for other alternative school programming.
Williams adds, these are the kids who are at the greatest risk. Anchorage School Superintendent Carol Como complimented individuals and groups who helped create the new alternative facility. But her greatest praise was accompanied by an invitation.
I really do commend the students for taking a chance, coming back into our system. We want you to get back into the system once you're ready to apply to be reinstated so that you can make a progress toward that high school diploma. In my mind, the most critical thing young people can acquire today at a minimum is a high school diploma, because then your options are open.
Governor Sean Parnell, whose early arrival that morning allowed him a chance to talk individually with the students, offered them a personal example.
The choices I made when I was 16 enabled me to be here today and doing a job that I love on behalf of our citizens. So I really want to paint a vision for you of success coming out of Step Up, that this is a community program, this is a community partnership that is about helping you create that future that you want to create for yourself and that's possible, things that you cannot even dream or think imaginable at this point.
The governor also promised state backing for the Step Up effort.
I'm really here to put the mantle of support from the state and say, yes, we are with you, Step Up. We're gonna work with you, partner with you on this.
Thursday morning's open house packed the small ground floor office suite next to the 9-star school on 4th Avenue. There were school board members and district staff, police officers, students, agency, and United Way officials. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan and U.S. Attorney Karen Loeffler both spoke. Glancing about the crowded room, Williams turned to expenses. He said, while the program was not costless, it is lean.
The Step Up program is clearly not a high-ticket item. The fact that you're all standing around here because you can't sit down, there's not enough room for you to sit down, it should be the first clue. Anchorage School District did hire one new teacher for this program, but with some exceptions, much of this program represents a reallocation of resources. Our plan is to have 12 students in the program this year and grow to 25 students over the next year.
With the exception of a half dozen or so new computers, the facility does have a Spartan but welcoming quality. Williams said, including the reallocations and that newly hired teacher, the total cost for Step Up's first year's operation comes to about $200,000. He said it's money well spent, for Step Up funding looks pretty good when compared to the amount needed if those suspended kids who had no school available began causing more trouble, either within gangs or simply on their own. This is Len Anderson.
Ed Ronco is the new reporter at KCAW in Sitka. He arrived in Alaska late last month after an 11-day road trip in an 11-year-old car. The goal? To complete the trip without needing a mechanic. And as Ronco tells us, his father came along on the trip with a goal of his own in mind.
When I announced to my parents in July that I'd be moving to Alaska, 3,200 miles from our hometown near Detroit, my dad was almost more excited than I was. I'd be starting a great new job in an incredible part of the world, whereas my dad, a retired teacher, now had an opportunity to golf his way across the country. Dad played in North Dakota on the way out here, and he'll play in Oregon on the way home. His Alaska round consisted of two trips through the 9 holes at the new Sea Mountain Golf Course in Sitka, which is nearing the end of its first full season. Playing the course moves Dad closer to his goal of golfing 18 holes in all 50 states.
I've got 44 done, and Oregon will be 45. I need Hawaii, Kansas, Oklahoma, New Jersey, and Rhode Island, and that'll make 50.
For a Michigan golfer, Sea Mountain is a marvel of engineering and nature. Artificial greens and tees and views of blue water, swooping eagles, and paths that feel more suited to a roller coaster car than a golf cart. And for my dad, a pretty decent golfer, it was also a lesson in humility.
I did purchase more golf balls on the second time around. And luckily, I finished. I still had 2 in my pocket after buying another 3. So a total of 10 golf balls, finished with 2.
A lot of people experience that, according to Roger Sidnikovich. He designed the course and now spends most of his waking hours maintaining it.
People don't score real well because it's tough. It's a tough course to play. But what that's going to make you for the beginning golfer here, and they stick with it, they'll be better golfers because they'll put their drivers away and try to play a smart game of golf.
So Nikovich and I get in a cart and ride to the number 2 tee. Keeping the course in business is a lot of work, he says, but it's a project he's tremendously proud of.
Well, we're looking out right now. We're looking all the way out to Bjorka, St. Lazarus. It's really quite a view. It's really spectacular.
The course went up with the help of numerous volunteers and grants. This summer was the first full season at Sea Mountain, which sits on about 50 acres near HPR and Granite Creek Road. Business is decent, he says, but there have been some problems. Inexperienced golfers keep breaking clubs on the driving range, and when Sidnikovich started working on the course at the beginning of the season, he says he found some damage from cross-country skis and plenty of trash.
We come back this year. That was also this year. There was old sleighs left on number one, Vis Queen, whiskey bottles, different alcohol bottles, water bottles, everything thrown over the site. And it's, like I say, we want people to enjoy it, but take care of it here. Yeah. And it's pretty sad when people don't.
Golfer Steve Postgen tees up a ball on number 7 as his friend Mike Reif looks on.
Holy cow.
Thank you.
That's an excellent hit.
Postgen says he doesn't take his score too seriously, an attitude that's served him well at Sea Mountain.
A little treacherous at times, though. You know, use the trees and rocks to your advantage. Ricochet back on the course.
Like Postgen, my dad wasn't worrying too much about his score either. That's good, because he shot an 85 on 18 holes, including 8, yes, count them, 8 penalty strokes. He has advice for those who have yet to golf the course.
Yeah, just enjoy it, and don't worry about your score. Just come out, enjoy it, and play it. And boy, when you look at the views, you won't care what your score is.
The United States Golf Association will be visiting the course, hopefully later this month, to rate its difficulty. Dad says they should plan to bring some extra golf balls. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Ed Ronco in Sitka, and Len Anderson in Anchorage. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
BP, teaming up with Alaskans since statehood and together looking toward a bright future.
And by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30th, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus Oregon Province.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.